And welcome to the Dice to Screen Podcast.
Oh,
that was a howl.
The dice are howling.
Oh, howling mad?
Baby, they're howling for you.
Oh, okay. Well, hey, I'm Randy.
I'm Mike.
And welcome to the Dice to Screen Podcast, brought to you by the letter no. We're not going to even do that.
The okay. Letter no?
Yeah, the letter no. It's a... No one likes it, but it's here.
So. Would you like a helping of vitamin? No.
No.
On a platter of no. Served with a helping, side helping.
I was gonna. No. I was gonna go somewhere else, but you can expect no less from the gaming podcast.
Oh my gosh, the dynamic duo of gaming podcasting, whose superpowers include marginal forgetfulness and severe lower back pain.
Oh. So. They are superpowers indeed, and we lean into them, sir.
We may not save the world, but we made it out of bed today.
We did.
We made it here. We're actually doing this.
Yeah. So, I thought we were going to be the gaming podcast that double specialized in thumb wrestling.
Ooh, that would have been even better.
Well, we'll save that for next
week. Double specialized in thumb wrestling.
Oh, you laugh now. Wait
till somebody declares a thumb war. Okay. We are so ready.
So
ready. Yeah, our character is OP for this. Okay?
Yeah. So.
We paid a steep price in building points to achieve this supremacy in one minute area.
We have it. So, we have a nice little show. We're going to be talking about Eberron today. And, of course, it's a classic campaign setting. We want to say classic because, well, it came out in the early 2000s out of a contest to find a new campaign world. And I also want to say that we've been wanting to do it a while because there are a lot of elements that would make it classic even without having almost 20 plus years on. It's getting close to the 20 year mark for them, but no, we're not quite there yet. But the fact that it's been around and it changed the scope of D&D and introduced a lot of new ideas without changing anything about D&D itself is remarkable.
It's one of those moments where they got it right, okay? Mm-hmm. Say what you will about the campaign, but the execution of the release of the material and the containment of it in a setting that, like, it worked perfectly within that setting and did not disrupt the rest of D&D. It's not like, you know, they poisoned the well. Like, oh, here's this radical new concept, and now it's in everything. And there's no way to escape from it. No, did not happen that way. They did it right. There's a lesson to be paid attention to there. That you can introduce a very different campaign style, a lot of very alien concepts. That you can put this stuff in a campaign setting and get it out there. Give people the toolkit they can work with and make them happy. So we're going to do a little pick apart on Eberron today.
Right.
We do have some sad news to discuss.
Yeah, we could have covered it last week, but we already were in high gear. So
yeah, we had a lot to cover last week. The topic we chose was just that big. There was no choice but to go for extra innings.
Yeah, we saved it at the last part of the podcast because we wanted to start out with a good hit and not bring ourselves down because, well, you know, it's never happy to announce the passing of somebody who's been influential for a long period of time. And that person is, of course, Jim Moore, who passed away on March 19th. Sorry, at home with family, and he was 72 years old.
Yeah. Drawmidge.
Yeah, Drawmidge. Famous for dispelling his name backward, Jim Moore, Drawmidge. One of the original participants at Gary's Table. He had a pretty lengthy career at TSR, starting off with one of the Deities and Demigods hardback. I mean, he had done some other stuff for the booklets, but yeah, the Deities and Demigods hardback, he had really pushed the envelope for what you could expect out of TSR at the time. I mean, this was with game companies like Game Designers Workshop doing a very sparse but densely packed information, almost a textbook-like, with the Traveler game. And Greg Stafford's, you know, just way, it's way out there, dude. It's got ducks and jackal bears and RuneQuest, which was a highly sophisticated setting, but had a high, and with a greatly detailed but pantheon, also, but also had a sense of whimsy about it as well.
That's the term I was going to use. There was a sense of whimsy.
Yeah.
No, no, it's all right. I mean, it's a perfect description of like the miracle that is RuneQuest is that it had that like playfulness about it that never, ever evaporated. It never went away. They never got to like, we're a very serious game. Mm-hmm. And you need to understand how very serious this very serious game is. Oh, you know, like, get that smile off your face. We've got to be scowling thoughtfully. No. They never let that steal the love for sitting down and playing.
But then aside,
Mr. Ward, he pushed the envelope like during the award-winning period of like rising interest in D&D. He was there for all of those early stages of development and growth that moved us out of the, you know, war gamers, you know, like, limited to, you know, the white box editions and chainmail variants and things like that. He was one of the people instrumental in the growth to like, how do we make this more approachable, more presentable? How do we, you know, deliver this to the public? And it turns out that guy could get it done. I mean, you know, like there are gamers who like certainly had a place at TSR early on without, how do I put this? They didn't really have the greatest sense of professionalism in terms of publishing, but they found themselves in the business of it. And they learned as they went. Mr. Ward was, I think, honestly, one of the most consummate professionals of the bunch.
And they early... give credit where credit's due, Tim Kask.
Yeah.
He was basically a guy that learned as he went. But they all brung with them a sense of professionalism. Okay, you know, they're given a great...
With great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah, they have a great opportunity here to make, you know, a great product. And Deities and Demigods, the hardback, and the little staple booklet with the old D&D had his name on it as well. That was one that really got people's attention because every D&D had not only a stat block, but an illustration. Now, also remember, a lot of people currently remember. Oh, there's a lot of boobas in there. Well, yep, you know, wow, I never knew.
Welcome to Mythology 101 and history and art and even architecture and sculpture and everything else. So, yeah, there's you could say there's an awful lot of boobies said there. You could say that about literally everything prior to the last 100 years.
Yeah, don't go to an art museum anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah, you just literally got to lock yourself in a dark room and play make-believe that nothing else ever existed.
You're going to see a little bit more than boobies.
Which, geez, reminds me of going to the museum district in Chicago.
Well, yeah, but anyway, Jim Ward, you know, he did a great job getting that book together. And then he remained on staff. You know, we also have to give the credit where credit's due. This is a big one for him. The credit for the first science fiction role-playing game, Metamorphosis Alpha. Now, you can say what you want about the game stylistically, but it was the first real attempt to put a science fiction setting into a role-playing game. And while it was a little contrived, you know, you're all stuck on a spaceship and you're traveling through space and some great accidents occurred and now you're just waking up out of your cryo sleep and there's mutants and
the arcologies have run wild.
Yeah, everything's awry. No. Even the plants are trying to kill you, so you're trying to find out what the heck happened. So it is kind of a contained campaign of like if you could just consider like the ships hurtling through space and you don't know if there's a captain left or any part of the crew that have sequestered themselves away. So there's a big mystery to solve. And that is something I think a lot of people just overlook for the element like, so I'm going to play a mutant or a pure strain human wandering out of his cryo sleep capsule. Yep. Those are your options. And, you know, random generation table made playing mutant half the fun. Now, two heads with a frill. Okay. and also a crippling fear of plants.
Zaphod Beeblebrox. In so, an Edwardian collar.
Yeah, so there, again, there's that sense of whimsy we're talking about with the seriousness. So, you know, it was tongue-in-cheek. And then, of course, Gamma World would come out later. It was more redefined and opened it up. But, you know, things like the cryptic alliances and the technology, the how to figure out what an artifact does. It could be a hairdryer, or it could be a microwave pistol. So, yeah. Maser. So you don't know.
When testing it, you may want to aim it at your cup of coffee before you pull the trigger, rather than just testing it out on your own hair.
But rather than having a question and answer session that would be almost endless, they put the technology artifact tables in it. So that's where it started. But a lot of people also had their hand in that, including the aforementioned Tim Kask, and some new people came in, like Dave Cook in the second edition Gamma World, who started to put things together. And hey, you know, that's the kind of atmosphere it was at TSR that made the sort of those days unique. And for a lot of people, a lot of us, when we first started getting into gaming, those books seemed, there was a lot of sometimes subtle humor hidden within. Let's put it this way. Those dang mutant bunnies, like 9 foot tall carnivorous rabbits, the hoops.
Ah, yes.
The hoops.
Yeah.
They can turn anything, the metal that they touch, into rubber.
Which, yeah, weird.
What were they smoking?
You just
have to say.
Oh, man. Early days of TSR. It was a wilderland, but one of the trailblazers was Jim Ward.
He was there with the Gamma World and the Metaverse Alpha and the Gamma World, deities and demigods. People got a little understandably upset when some of their characterizations, like Vedican Hindu Indian pantheons were put in there. Some of the people, you know, this isn't mythology, this is real to us. So, yeah, they kept that, but they also had the problem with the Cthulhu and Melnibian pantheons that had to be taken out of the deities and demigods. And so, you know, he was there and taking the heat on that in the high chair as well, you know, in the captain's seat, he was taking that. And that, I think, prepared him for when Gary departed. He took over the helm of TSR for a few years before eventually he stepped down, became vice president.
He was the interim guy.
Yep, he kept, he also came out with Greyhawk Adventures hardback right at the transition point between first and second edition.
Yes, which I have a lovely copy of, and I was actually looking at it just the day before yesterday. I was eyeballing it because it had his name on it. You know, like, and it just leaped out. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, like, sat there thinking, oh, man. Oh, Jim.
You know. Yeah, but Expedition to Barrier Peaks and other.
Oh.
In people. It's mutant and mayhem in Greyhawk.
Mostly mayhem. But when is it not? Especially if you or I are playing.
Oh, what can turn into a random encounter can change the entire shape of a continent. Yep, that's us.
But yeah, we salute you, Jim Ward. You are much missed. You brought a lot of creativity and kind of set the bar for mixing creativity with professionalism, you know, because there is... I want to put this as politely as possible. I don't mean to insult a lot of the creatives who are working in the business today and of yesteryear. But oftentimes, considerable creativity does not come hand in hand with great talent at management, self-management, you know, deadline meeting, you know, really sharp, clean-cut professionalism in production. Value, you know, the creatives depend upon a lot of other people to get those things done, or they wind up suffering in many respects because they're not able to accomplish those things all by their lonesome. Jim kind of raised the bar.
Yeah.
You know, one of those guys who really could splice
down
the
middle. A lot of writers in the community owe a lot to him. I've seen Jamie Chambers was talking about it. And, he felt he had a lot of obligations and debts. And Matt Fobrick also said that he was greatly inspired by Jim Ward's mentorship and counseling about how to get started in the business and how to meet deadlines. Just like you said, there was a lot of professionalism in how he approached it because, well, he was an enthusiastic amateur who got pulled in at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and he just happened to have a lot of native talent, not to mention a great work ethic.
He made some mistakes early on.
Sure.
And rather than dwelling on them or let that...
Of course, when you remember that, like, a lot of this was taking place, like, he was a 27-year-old by the time things were really taken off. Like, a guy who's not yet 30.
Yeah.
And, like, this little thing they were operating out of a garage morphed rather rapidly. Like, in the space of only a couple of years, they went from 0 to 60. Mm-hmm. With the rubber hitting the road, just Fast and Furious style. Just dropped them out of an airplane and they land on the highway doing 100 miles an hour. The screaming demon the whole way, just And he managed, He overcame whatever inadequacies he started off with.
I think that's a lesson that you take from his legacy, is that you can take some of the life lessons that you had, mistakes and regrets you had, and not dwell on them, but use them as learning points and show people, well, I can't tell you how to make this successful, but I can tell you what not to do.
Yeah. Here's a list of things that I guarantee, I know for a fact, will not work. Because I tried, not just once.
Unfortunately, we're at that time where, life takes more than it gives, but we have a lot to celebrate. He has done a lot for TSR, for the gaming community as a whole. Some of the last stuff I understand, just to touch on this briefly, is he was involved with Giant Lands occasionally, kind of something with Lanasa. But just like we were talking with Ernie, some of these people, I think there is a certain type of culprit out there, a certain rat that preys on the goodwill of a lot of the older gamers who freely give of their time and wisdom and advice. And then they find themselves being used for nefarious purposes.
There are a lot of bad actors on the stage these days. That was far less common, like even just 20 years ago. You just really didn't see that kind of conduct in gaming. And it's one of the saddest things, like at this stage, like in this little zone, this lasted one decade.
Yeah, his Giant Lands project did seem to be one of love, but it wasn't well put together and it wasn't formulated quite well. And I see Frank Metzner has also had a little ruckus where he wanted to incorporate a campaign world that could be played in multiple different systems, which is applaudable, but
yeah,
he kind of went about it without really consulting a copyright lawyer, understanding how much this would entail. And then, got burned by it and then became a little upset. So the idea was that I didn't want to really end it on a sour note, but I wanted to say that Jim's life, he's not a perfect person, just like everyone.
Oh, God, no.
He made some mistakes, but you know what? He made the best of it. And I still consider the deities and demigods, because of the artwork choices and because of the stylistic choices to go with a multitude of mythologies that were collected under one cover, that were mostly real world, but occasionally touched like the Nuon pantheon, as well as the Mildivinian and Cthulhu. And the non-human deities, which were almost whole cloths created out of just pure imagination. Corellon, Rethian, Moradin, Maglabiot, fry your livers. Goblin curse heard all over.
Pre-arc.
Doesn't mean what you think it does.
I don't think that word means what you think it means. No, I got to say that for what it's worth, the contribution Mr. Ward made, it's a memorable one. Gamers are not going to forget it lightly. Yeah. Certainly not as long as there are people like us who are, you know, like we remember exactly how significant those contributions were. So we're not going to let that go. We will remind people as the opportunity comes up.
I think it's important to remember that at the time the game was forming, he was right there, and he was able not only to fulfill a niche at TSR that was needed, but he was a consistent and pretty firm presence at conventions, notorious for his killer DM modes. I don't kill you, player. I just let the players kill themselves.
Yeah.
There's a box. There might be gems in it, or there might be scorpions in it. Okay, I put my head in the box. Turns out it was scorpions.
Yep. That's.
Did they kill themselves? No. You totally killed them. But yeah, the fact is, it could be. You fall for it again every time. Lucy in the football. You know,
is it a portable hole or a sphere of annihilation? Hard to say. Very dangerous. You go first.
Throw the henchman. The torch bear.
Knobby foot.
Get in there, knobby foot.
Oh, man. All right. Shall we? Let's begin our discussion on Eberron. Do we have any new other news?
Yeah, just a couple of things. I mean, just to talk about our last podcast, we talked about combat from around D&D. We had a bonus session. I think we hit almost all the points we wanted. I kind of wanted to land on a couple of things. I felt that, like, I missed some opportunities. I got ahead of myself on a couple of things. But I did want to mention that, in lieu of all the changes in combat, I think one of the big things has always been for me to have a good grasp on the dramatic. And with a dry system like D&D, it doesn't have a lot of flavor. You don't get a lot, and you have to use your imagination. And I think that's more or less that I had to create something exciting out of just like, okay, roll a die. Did you hit or miss? Yeah, okay. So it's a pretty binary system. You either hit or you miss. So reading books like Robert E. Howard and Fritz Lieber's Adventures, as well as Edgar Rice Burroughs, I got kind of the feeling that there were a lot of near misses or happenstance, failed opportunities, parries, and last-minute dodges. And so I tried to weave that into the narrative. And that has been my one experience with D&D combat, where I make it my own. I didn't really let the limitations of the system stop me from making it exciting. I would get into it and be very verbal and animated. And I think that's one way I dealt with some of the complexities and vagueness of the system. So I just wanted to mention that. I felt like I didn't put that in there. I got ahead of myself. I got lost in the moment. Yeah, I get lost in the weeds is more like it. And I hear wolves.
Out come the wolves. Well, no, I honestly, I was very happy with last week. I looked at that, and afterwards, like, the extra session allowed us to make sure we included it as much as we had wanted to do, like, gave us the confidence. Not that we want to abuse the extra sessions all the time. Like, hour and a half is a long time for a podcast, not for most people. Like, you know, 2 30-minute segments, you know, is really our happy strike zone, where we get to do what we want. We don't have to sacrifice everything on the cutting room floor. And the listener isn't like, oh boy, I didn't know there would be this many words. Just well, having a Korgoth moment. I didn't know there would be this much talking. I'm sorry, man.
That's okay.
I can just see somebody terribly frustrated with Geno Bomb denied. Oh,
Space King.
Yeah, so that was the thing that happened.
Also, he had a good barbarian.
Oh, yeah, that went dark quick.
He gets his shirt. Purple. What? Purple. All right, so Just some gaming news. I mean, okay, so yeah, you've come to kind of expect it. No, we're not even going to touch anything. There's nothing happening with Wizards of the Coast. They're just fine this weekend. We hope that we wish them well on yet getting up to the 9-day mark of no embarrassing accidents happening at all.
Yes.
That said, some stuff coming out.
And we mean that sincerely. Yeah, please stick with it. You're doing great, kids. You're like, I know it hasn't been a whole lot of time under the belt yet, but
9 days.
One step at a time is how you get there.
One day at a time. Paizo's offering another Humble Bundle. No surprise there. They've been doing that. A lot of other games have been too. Mutant Carl Classics, Goodman Games did a Humble Bundle on that. A lot of good stuff there if you missed it. Some of their earlier stuff. They're thinking about reprinting again because it's all out of print. The secondary market's sky high, so. I wouldn't be surprised if you see another Humble Bundle from them that was very successful. But this is one, Paizo, is the Alkenstar Humble Bundle. And
up here, just a second. Guns of Alkenstar.
Yeah, the Guns of Alkenstar Bundle. And so for about $40, you get yourself a the basic one, for just $5, you get the second edition beginner box set, Adventure Path 178, Punks in a Powder Keg, the beginning of the Outlaws of Alkenstar, of a three-shot. So it's just a three-shot Adventure Path there. You get the first one there. The Player's Guide, and of course, a one-shot called Headshot in the Rot. So, and for $15, that goes up more. You get the second one, plus you get a second edition core rulebook PDF, bestiary, and Lost Omens World Guide, as well as a character guide, which is useful because you'll be an Alkenstar. And then for $30, you know, you get the full Adventure Path of the Smoking Gun, the third installment, Guns and Gears PDF, Lost Omens Impossible Land, the Advanced Player's Guide, Game Mastery Guide, and all the previous ones for VTTs, virtual tabletops, are on there. And then finally, if you pay the $40 tier, you'll also get a physical copy of Guns and Gears hardcover. So this is a pretty good value. I mean, the book alone is worth almost $50, or retails for $50. So for $40, you get a book, a bunch of PDFs, Adventure Path for Alkenstar. Look, if you've ever wanted to dip into steampunk or steampunk fantasy, here's your chance. And if you don't care, well, hey, you know, that's fine too, because, you know, if that's not your bag, well.
Hey, man, look, Pistols and Pegasi is not for everybody, but, you know, this is one of those scenarios where in the Alkenstar setting, you know, zone.
It's a dead magic. Well, it's a low magic zone, but also ostensibly magic is returned. But, you know, you have a lot of fierce critters and weird stuff going out there. So it's almost like a Boot Hill area.
Yeah, very intentionally.
The Mana Waste, as it's called. So the Impossible Lands and all that.
Totally worth a peek. Because, like, hey, remember, you know, Six Guns and Sorcery in the back of the DM guide, you know, tells you that it's a long tradition of, like, hey, you know, wait till you try splicing these two things.
Yep.
If you think your peanut butter and your chocolate are great separate, wait till you put these together.
Yeah, so you can just check that out on Paizo's site, or you can go to Humble Bundle and look up the Guns of Alkenstar, and I'll send you right there. Sorry, I think that's about the news, and then we'll be back with Ebron. We'll jump right into it, so stick around. Right. All right, and we're back. So, yeah, we're about ready to dive in deep to Ebron. And before we get that, we would be remiss if we didn't do our public service announcement. What's going on? What's our next episode?
And alas, you're going to be on tenterhooks for a while because we don't have the Astrogallomancer. He is on hiatus. You know what? Who are we kidding? He's in rehab. His friends held an intervention. And it turns out a lot of that that was not divinatory incense at his house.
I was always a little sus about that. I always had like this weird, like I'd walk away and then it would be like, oh, there's something. I just feel so weird.
Yeah, yeah. So, look, putting a bright side on it, while he's on hiatus, he's getting the help he genuinely needs. So, you know,
yeah,
it's a positive takeaway.
Let's good support for him.
You know.
In this, and you know, he's just gonna get better, so he'll be back soon, though. Don't worry,
someday the Astrogallomancer will return. But for now, What happens next week is a surprise.
Yeah.
You don't know. Not that we don't know. It's that you don't know. Yeah, I'm totally teasing you with it,
too. Oh, yeah. So
I'm fluttering the kimono and just not letting anything go. Yeah.
What's better than fluttering from the back? And it was Taco Tuesday last night. So, yeah, we got that one out. All right. So yeah.
Now, let's launch, man. Eberron. We've been looking forward to this. It's one of the things that this is an old school oversight of ours. We never got around to covering this setting except as like a side mention when we were talking about the vast variety of settings that have been made available. We did not do a deep dive pick apart on Eberron, which, not because it didn't deserve it, just honestly, we wound up with a whole lot on our plate and just kept covering other things and never got back to it. And I remember at the time thinking, oh my gosh, you're like, we got to do an episode on this. It's too big not to.
Yeah, so let's start with the conversation, set it up here. Eberron was the campaign winner in a contest back in 2002.
Yeah.
About 11,000 entries, and Keith Baker's made it to the top of the pile.
Made it through the elimination rounds. And oh my gosh, you know, it's a subject of some vitriol. Mm-hmm. There was some bitterness, but like, honestly, we don't have the time to focus on all of that. If we're going to give the actual setting the credit that it's due, doing the ultra deep dive on just the grumpiness and the post politics and all of that, I don't think we're able to give it justice.
And we're here to celebrate things, not tear them down. So,
and I gotta say, if we're just gonna fast forward to the ending, that like, however it came to pass, Eberron was a hell of an accomplishment. So, you know, like, anybody's like, oh, like some piece of crap got in where somebody else should have gotten it. No, that's not the case. Here, you got something.
You're gonna say that about anything, about anyone.
Yeah,
God forbid. So.
I feel like that was, you know, like that is being wildly unfair to the product itself. It was good enough that it prospered through the additions.
Right. But the original name was, when it was that initially proposed, was Thrilling Tales of Swords and Sorcery. And that led a lot to a pulp or film noir background, along with steampunk and fantasy tropes mixed up inside of it.
Which is part of my affection for it, despite not having played in that campaign, having only read it. You've got to remember, like, we are the podcast of tropes that feed gamerdom, like what makes good DMs, like all of this research,
or
all
inspired,
of these tropes,
yeah,
all of these inspirations, and things that we homage in gaming. Well, this is how a great campaign gets made. You know?
Right, and it put it landed some fantasy tropes from Tolkien, traditional elves, dwarves, goblins, orcs, and all that, along with some of the established tropes about D&D, you know, different races combating each other and hostily, and it completely changed the expectation. And it sets in after a large war, you know, they use magical forces, seen combating among the warring nations. And one of them came out with some kind of spooky nuke, as I've heard it called, that reduced a nation down to a bunch of ghosts that are now hanging out, called the Harrowlands. And so, yeah, it definitely put it in there. And there's an uneasy peace, and it kind of resembles the Age of Wonder between World War One and World War Two, mixed with some of the steampunk fantasy of airships and, you know, Magitek, like the Warforge is a race that came out of this one, and including some other ones. And also took every D&D monster and gave them a new look. So let's talk about the background of the campaign itself. So the name Eberron is actually the world originated by three dragons.
Three dragons.
Inside you, fighting.
Which one wins? The one you feed.
So one of them...
my inner dragon is...
Oh, no.
Rage.
Oh, yeah. That...
I feed him as much as he wants. Gina Bob tonight.
So the Eberron is the name of the world because the dragon Kyber killed its sibling, Cerberus, who is now a magical asteroid ring.
Yeah.
And also the birth of the dragons. And so Eberron covered Kyber to keep him from inflicting evil. So Kyber is the underworld, which is literally in the underworld. And then Eberron itself is the landmass. And so these three dragons, their death cycle, their fights, and victories have all manifested to make the land inhabitable. So with that, that is a pretty deep high fantasy trope right off the bat. And then it changes because the major inhabitants of the continent that this most likely takes place is Corvair.
Yes, Corvair.
And it was inhabited by goblins, of all things, at first. They were the dominant race until humans came and, you know, started taking over.
Things went how you might predict. Not great for the goblins.
Yeah, and that led to the various nations being formed. They eventually came into conflict, and then there was a great war, and it resulted in the unleashing of devastating magics, which caused all the nations to retreat back to the peace table where they should have been in the first place.
Yeah, it's like, oh man, let's not do that again. But the aftermath of war is an important tidbit of this. It's like much like the parallel to the gap period between World War One and World War Two. You know, like you're looking at a place that like people are still picking up the pieces.
Yeah, that, shattered lives.
Yeah. So there is a wonderful flair for grimdark style. You know, that grimdark pretension that you see in things like fantasy wargaming, you know, by the people who made Warhammer 40K. Mm-hmm. This was, I think, to me, D&D's one genuine grimdark outing.
Where, or yeah, as how close to it as they got. Grimdark without imitating Games Workshop's Warhammer Fantasy.
Thank you. It would have been just really sad to watch them like, yo, total copycat, this is our version of Grimdark, and have it be ludicrously similar. No. Instead, this.
Yeah,
very innovative, very original.
It also has a lot to do with Bill Slavishek, if we're saying that right, hopefully. And
Mr. Bad Wrong Fun.
Yes.
Look, I don't, like, this is not, I'm not going to go off about the other guy. We're not talking about that. Mr. Slavishek was, like, one of the great, contributors, once again, to Paranoia. Bill was, I believe he had his fingers in that pie as well.
Yeah, it's in Star Wars, the role-playing game.
Yeah, a lot of great product. It just, you know, like, at the time that the 4th edition fiasco happened.
Right, well.
So he gets a little tarnish on his rep for that, but that's what we're
doing. But this was well before that, and also James Wyatt, who would later go on with Paizo and others. But, yeah, these three collaborated with, it's Keith Baker, right?
Yeah.
Keith Baker, right. Okay, so Keith Baker, he'd written a campaign, and so they all sat down and they decided, okay, we're going to pare some stuff down, we're going to boil it down, and we're going to sharpen it up. So they all went to work on this in different ways. And I think that it showed that this was, they just took the bare bones of this, that the submission, I think you had to submit a 100 or some odd page synopsis, when you got into the finals, it had to be 100-page writing. The original writing, I think, was just a couple, like 10 pages.
But. Yeah, the when they say 11,000 submissions, a lot of those were eliminated in the opening round, where very little was asked of people in terms of what they had to prepare to be one of the first entrants. But if you did manage to make it to that next round, you needed much more significant documentation. By the time you got to the final rounds, you really had to make it clear that you had this well fleshed out and well prepared.
And here's just an adjacent note I want to make, just a real quick segue. It's like a lot of people compare Eberron to Ravnica, and I'm like, no, you're getting it wrong. Ravnica is more like Eberron. I think there is a certain comparison that could be made there because the hyper focus on urban centers, just a huge urban city, comes from one of the first supplements, Sharn, the City of Splendors, or Towers, I think. Did I get that right? Gosh darn it. I'm just like all over the place with my half notes here. But yeah, the City of Sharn supplement was basically like a city noir with monsters, mafia, and magic. Literally, like, it was like you could just do a hard-boiled detective plot with you're just an investigator down on his luck on his last few gold pieces, and in walks a dame, you know, an elf, and she's got a problem, and boy, did I have it coming.
This is what I get for taking jobs based on lookers.
Yeah. So, yeah, you could have that, but also there's a dark fantasy side. So I guess let's, do we want to talk about a little bit about the campaign itself? Some of the areas, we'll just gloss over those. We don't want to take too much time with that. Got a minute or two. And talk about like the goblins. They have a big city called, Dargoon, where it's just a land full of where they're left with mercenaries and, guilds and, you know, open air dungeons, you know, ruins, and they're just trying to eke out their living best as they can. Also, the Zalargo, where basically the highest center of learning in the lands are, the huge library, all the gnomes, and this is where science is cooked up, and weird, you know, the conceptions of the last war, a lot of the weapons were forged here. The Eldine Reaches with the Talking Tree, the Archdruid, who is just a massive tree. Wow, what a promotion. You're going to be a tree. Okay, well, I used to be, when I was the Archdruid, you know, I just, became a Hierophant after serving the council 1 year. Nope, you're stuck here as a tree.
Yeah, this is your last promotion. Everything else is lateral, yeah, assuming they cut you down.
The Lazar Principalities, the Pirate Lords, which, you know, just a whole area on the coast of just buccaneers, privateers, and pirates, and... the Moror holds, the Dwarven who delved a little too deep.
Oh, yes.
And Thronehold, what is my place, is like the entertainment capital, which is also full of intrigue, spies, and corruption. So, yeah, you get a lot of themes of
civilization, ancient and wicked.
But where everything matters, where everything happens, it's Sharn, is the big city. But Thronehold also, like, it's the entertainment capital of Corvair. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, so it's like Hollywood. And yeah, Hollywood Noir or Hollywood Confidential.
Now, I did want to talk about, if you'll indulge me just a moment, I wanted to focus on the relationship between the steampunk-esque tidbits that were also included in this setting. Yes. The technologies powered by magic, but familiar to us as things that are more driven by science. A wonderful splicing of those things, most notably including like the development of the Warforged, which for whatever reason, though I think we know what the reason is, okay, power gamers everywhere flocked to the idea of being a fighting machine.
Right.
That, you know, I'm basically like... I'm like this close to medieval battle tech, you know?
Right?
I'm that close. I'm like kissing cousins. You're like, that's how close this is. This is a gnat's whisker away from everything else I've ever loved about like being in a giant suit and kicking butt.
Their name says it all.
Connected instantly at some primal level with a lot of gamers. So much so that, like, I honestly think to some degree that's like the one tidbit that still get dredged up. Like, I have run into people who are like, can't I run a Warforged character in your campaign? Like, I'm not in Eberron, dude. I'm like, but I want to run a Warforged. Like, if I ever run an Eberron campaign, you are welcome to be a Warforged, but I'm not porting it over into this campaign where it does not belong in. Is wildly
right, but I think that the theme there is like just like Tieflings originated in Planescape.
Yeah,
they migrated to other campaign worlds by default. You know, they got into like, I never have a half demon or a demon in Greyhawk. I'm like, oh, Ayaz. I mean, he's a Cambion. That's right in his name. It says he's a Cambion. Oh well, he's a god. Okay, I hear you, but I also submit that if he is a byblow of a demon lord and a human, a mortal, then isn't there others?
Yeah, and surely this there, is
good. Yeah, and wouldn't that make an epic hero that you would want to kind
of especially see? After they fleshed out very specific descriptions of exactly those beings in other textbooks. So yeah.
But Warforged is a bit of a different one. So
very different.
And it is an exacting principle made out of enchanted wood and metals and given sentience and a spark of creativity from elemental forces. They formed the bulk of the fighting in the last war. And
especially towards the end.
Yes, because people were tired of dying. And
yeah, well, they were running out of people to fling into the grist mill.
You know, you basically, like, we just covered just a few of the places on the continent. But a closer look shows, you know, Eberron was meant to handle D&D tropes and themes in a differently toned setting, alongside Skyships, Warforged, in a grim, dark fantasy realm. And that is one of the selling points, I think, made it to the top of the heap. Despite all the aspersions aside, I think that in third edition, its origin story is firmly tied to the very need to have a brand new campaign world that broke the barriers of the previous ones of Greyhawk and Forgotten Realms. No matter how much you can say there's a difference between the world of Greyhawk and Forgotten Realms, they are very similar on many, many levels. Yes. Okay, well, there's no Cult of the Dragon in Greyhawk. Well, yeah, there's no Scarlet Brotherhood inside. Yeah. Oh, but there's the Red Wizards of Thay. Okay, so they share a color.
Yes, every planet has, like, there's Cult of the A-hole.
The purple, yeah. The Veiled Society, the purple assholes. Yep.
That is just a thing that, like, DMs need an oppositional force, and so it's going to exist in every campaign world. But in terms of fantasy settings, and the interchangeability of spells, abilities, classes, and things like that, Greyhawk and Forgotten Realms, visibly, like, you could take a character from one and drop them into the other with very little in the way of editing.
Right.
Not so Eberron, okay?
Right. You may, to steal from another podcaster, find your expectations of a beholder are going to be completely different. You could find a beholder running an orphanage and not eating any of the children, actually caring for them.
It's important that they remain because these are free-range orphans. You know how much more their meat is worth?
Okay. But no, an actually nurturing beholder. You can find one. Right, right. I get you. That would be, you know, its concern is there. You find the typical goblin mercenaries and slavers that you would typically find in a fantasy setting. But you could also find actual honest-to-goodness law enforcement. Private detectives that the hobgoblins are renowned for their scrupulous behavior when they take a job for investigations.
Well, I mean, yeah, even canonically, like, they're lawful evil, not like crazy chaotic.
Yeah, but the alignment is
more. I love the job stuff.
We almost see like alignment being scrubbed away in a lot of things. Yeah, demons are very still much bad. So. And, you know, but even some of the druids, like in that. In the Eldine Reaches, like, you mess with a tree, they'll feed you to the damn dinosaurs. They're not kidding around. They're not letting you strip this down for materials to fight a war with. They're done.
Like, yeah, they've been radicalized by necessity.
Yeah. So you have a lot of...
We need all your lumber. Like, if you're a real patriot, you'll understand. We need all your lumber. No. No.
You understand this.
Well, then, if you're not with us, you're against us. You're going to regret putting it that way.
So let's talk about some of the other races here while we're talking about the Warforged, which is a distinct and characteristic race that has, by its very popularity, as you mentioned, transitioned to other campaign worlds. It's made that jump. You know, so, like, you could have Warforged and Greyhawk, to be honest. If you look at the realm of Blackmoor, they could come right out of there. Or in one of the lost cities buried under the desert. In Faerun.
Oh, yeah, in the Mythal. You know, some of the long-forgotten places where the borders between existences might be a little blurry.
Or an ancient technology that just was...
Nobody's saying you can't do it. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of porting over something radically different. But you know what? To practice what I preach, like I tell people, like, if that is something you want to put in your campaign, find a way. Like,
Help me help you.
I don't have to approve, you know? If that is a thing that you look at and you think, I think this might be pretty cool, you go for it.
Well, some of the races they also came up, besides the Warforged that don't get enough mention, is the Changelings, which were a doppelganger type that they could not just change their shape to radically different forms like a doppelganger almost could. But they had just a few forms that they could change as they started. So it was a much more limited approach.
Yeah.
Although doppelgangers are limited to humanoids, they can't change them themselves into the chest. They're not like Odo or the from Deep Space Nine, the Founders. But they have the ability to take humanoid form, and they have a select few forms that they learn, and then they get more as they go along. That's an interesting race because they really are an adaptive race that has to look at others. They don't have any culture of their own, and they have to adapt to whoever's around them. And they learn to be part of that society, but yet they're still innately separate. So there's that you can play. And then there's
Without like any of the like excessive power that, you know, you would expect of people who want to be, you're not dealing with something that is so OP that you like, you laughed, I laughed, the table laughed, we shot the table. It was a great time. No, it was thought out in a way that it could be, you know, graded, and allowed to grow, and, you know, exist in party play.
Well, you couldn't imitate
without imbalance
the mob boss.
Yeah,
exactly. But you could take a general form and posture, much assuming that. Nonetheless, they also had the Callister, which is basically they're psionic folk that are inhabited by a spirit, the Quarry, and this gives them a duality nature. Now, I see a lot of people get like, oh, I'm going to play a schizophrenic. I've kind of always been a little shy of that one, but I get the concept that, yes, you have a duality of purpose, that there are two beings inside of you, but only one at a time can have access to the control panel of your, you know, mind. So, you know, you can be two different people in the same character, so... radical approach for multi-classing, and that was something I think mechanically they were trying to adopt. Whether it survived or translated well, I'm not one, but I get the concept, and so that's an interesting trope.
I see where they were trying to go with it, and I don't disapprove of the creativity, but yeah, like the execution possibly could have been a little bit better.
Yeah, I just think that people went with it in a weird way. They were trying, I think, to get really heavy-handed behind the whole multi-classing. But then the shifters, which are more like lycanthropes. Like, instead of being a full-on were-creature, you could take limited aspects of a creature at early levels, and then you would develop to a full-fledged form later on.
At long last, with enough time and effort, I can look forward to being a full were-Pekingese.
Because that's a thing, I guess.
I'm sorry, I never got over River of the Dancing Gods. Yes, it did. Yeah.
But then you had the houses, which added a further factionalism to it, and the dragon marks, which were specialized to certain races and classes. So that's where people make some comparisons to Ravnica and some other settings. It's like, I think, since it's under the same house, we have the same sort of thing going on here, where it was just adjacent and it kind of crept in. But the third edition came pretty much, it came in with the 3.0 and then transitioned almost immediately 6 months later to 3.5. So they had to have released another book to recapitulate the rule, new changes to the rules. And so I think that also hurt it a little bit, that they were so fast to push it out for third edition, but wanted to, they took their time with it. They didn't push it out as fast as they could have. They spent a lot of time crafting it. And then 3.5, which was happening in a different area of the Wizards of the Coast game development team. They had to make some changes to that because some of the thematic changes were pretty considerable and it changed a little bit of Eberron. But then
yes,
we come to the one that you honestly don't like to talk about, but we're actually going to be pretty good about this one. It's the fourth edition.
Hey, and you know what? I've been working on myself, okay? People who have been watching, or rather I should say listening to this, listening to these, you know, two idiots ramble. Mm. If you've been listening to us long enough, you know that I still have some fairly strong feelings about what was wrong with 4th edition, but I have been working very hard to be a little more open-minded in both the way I, you know, discuss 4th edition. Like, it should not just break down to a predictable, you know, like, burst of fury.
But
there are some quality elements from 4th edition, and Eberron actually was the one campaign setting where I felt like this belongs here. Like, 4th edition, this is the experimental playground for you, Eberron. I did not feel resentment.
Yeah, they started out as a 3rd edition beast, and they made the transition to 4th edition. But one of the big design things, I think, is they tried to move Eberron. Supposedly, there was going to be a timeline advance, and I'm not 100% up on this. I wasn't really paying too much attention, but I've been able to do a little research on it. They were going to move the timeline up a little bit and maybe develop some ideas. But they ended up pulling it back, and they wanted to do what was called a points of light design, where there were just centers of civilization. The rest of the place was wilder. But by that time, various DMs had their own ideas of what Eberron was going to be. And so there was a lot of pushback. And I think it was poorly executed.
Because people had been playing at that point for about 5 or 6 years. You know, they had, well, not actually a little bit more than that.
Yeah.
They had active campaigns and a sense of vestment. And so having a radical shift to the campaign was met with about the same resistance as I experienced when they made big alterations to Forgotten Realms,
right,
which, like we've already heard many episodes ago, how I felt about them, like, the gods war. Oh, the crap fest that totally shit, well, that you shithoused my favorite campaign ever. Now we're running low on time.
Yeah, so I wanted to just land the plane on the 5th edition, which is Eberron Rising from the Last War, where they did move the timeline several years ahead. And now Eberron has been out for a while, and people have been able to enjoy it over again. So I think Eberron has had a good success, despite not being like one of the early hoary-bearded elder campaign settings.
Yeah, it may, like, may not have been one of the first, but it is absolutely worthy. And, you know, it's looked upon with great fondness by a great many gamers. You know, maybe not this, you or me to the same degree as some, but we don't look at it with disrespect.
Right. And if you need to mix fantasy tropes with steampunk and film noir, you can find a better one.
Yeah, one of the best places to do it. It has all the things in it that I approve of. So far be it from me to gripe.
Yeah, but I think that'll wrap it up. We got most of it down in 30 minutes, and we're ready to ship on out. So, hey, thanks for listening. And again, just see us on that Facebook page, not in our group, Dice is Screaming, for more announcements and see what's coming up. But until next time,
may the dice always roll in your favor. We're out.
See ya.